And thank the organizing committee, minus myself, very much for the invitation. It really is a great honor and privilege to speak in this company, and in particular to speak in honor of Kathleen's birthday. Happy birthday, and it's a wonderful occasion. I first met Kathleen when I was a postdoc at Courant in the early 70s. It was just a great experience to be there. I wasn't a postdoc of Kathleen, but I very much appreciated talking to Eugene Isaacson, who was actually my postdoc advisor, but also Kathleen and Peter and Louis. Kathleen, as I think everybody finds, was a great inspiration. She was extremely kind and generous with her time to all of us, and particularly to young people starting in their career. And I think throughout my career, I have very much benefited from Kathleen's support, and I really thank her very much. So what I will be talking about will be continuing this afternoon's discussion on the topic of incompressible fluids. So in particular, I'll be talking about the energy balance situation in the incompressible fluid equations. Most of what I'll discuss will be concerning the Euler equations and a little bit concerning Navier-Stokes. Now, I wonder, it has a memory. Curious. The work that I'll be discussing is mainly in a paper that is to appear in Nonlinearity together with Alexei Cheskidov, Peter Constantine, and Roman Shvidkoy. We were all Chicago people until I have just escaped the Chicago winter to California. The fluid equations, I think, are completely familiar to everyone in this audience, but to just to remind us, the Euler equations for the motion of an incompressible fluid, so the divergence of the velocity field U is equal to zero. These are the equations that I have written in black. We have, in fact, what looks on the face of it like a very simple system, and as we all know, is in fact an extremely complex system. Basically, we have a balance between the acceleration and the acceleration, which is this term, and the pressure term. And we will be considering this in whole space, or some of the results that I'll be describing will be in periodic domains. I won't be considering the issue of boundary conditions, which, as Claude pointed out, is actually extremely important in the energy balance situation, but the results are basically for R3. If we then considered the Navier-Stokes equations, we have an extra term, the term from the effects of viscosity, and with the Navier-Stokes equations, it is almost always reasonable to consider the forced Navier-Stokes equations, so we also have some forcing. Now, one very important feature of these equations, Euler or Navier-Stokes, is the so-called energy balance condition, or for the Euler equation, conservation of energy, which is obtained very easily. Take the dot product of the equation with the velocity, integrate over space, and we obtain the following. The pressure term disappears because we're in the divergence-free condition. P now here stands for the projection onto the space of divergence-free functions. So if this term, which is in some sense the sort of the crux of the matter for the nonlinear fluid equations, this term is skew symmetric, and this term, providing one can integrate by parts in this context, this term will disappear. But that may not actually always happen, and that's really the thrust of this talk. And then, of course, here we have the term, the dissipation of energy due to viscosity and possibly energy due to forcing. So, as I was mentioning, if we can integrate by parts, in other words, if the velocity field U is sufficiently smooth, and what we'll be coming to in a moment is what do we mean by the word sufficiently. If it's sufficiently smooth, then this term is actually equal to zero, which leads for the Euler equation to conservation of energy, or for the fluid equation, we have the energy balance between the rate of change of energy, the dissipation, and whatever energy is being inputted through the force. And in many contexts, this holds, and this is of sort of fundamental importance of much that one would do to analyze the behavior of the fluid equations. But it may be the case, as I say, that this actually does not vanish. And that is connected for the Euler equations at least, that is connected with possible lack of smoothness of the velocity field. So let us turn to consider weak solutions of the Euler equation. Now this is going on somewhat shaky ground because these are hypothetical weak solutions of the Euler equation. But assume that we have a weak solution of the Euler equation defined in the following way. So we have initial conditions in L2 of R3, test functions C infinity with divergence-free test functions, and then a solution is called a weak solution of the Euler equation if it satisfies the following condition as integrated against the test function. So we have U satisfies the following condition for all such test functions, and the divergence of U is equal to zero in the sense of distributions. Now, unfortunately, this color doesn't come out very well, but I haven't used green very often. So this term that I've labeled B is the trilinear term, which comes from, again, integrating against the test function, the nonlinear term, and we now have three terms in our integral, and here is the functional B. And it's this term that we're really very interested in. So as Claude told us, the notion of weak solutions of the Euler equation are very closely connected with ideas that physicists have for turbulence. Now, a turbulent fluid is a real fluid, and every real fluid is viscous. So the Navier-Stokes are the appropriate description of a real fluid. However, again, as Claude said, it is considered to be, by many of us, highly likely that it is, in fact, the Euler equations that one really needs to understand in order to examine the behavior of the Navier-Stokes equations in the limit of vanishing viscosity, which is where the turbulent phenomena will be living. So it makes sense to, in the context of turbulence, to try to examine the behavior of the Euler equations, and in particular the behavior of the Euler equations when the velocity field is rough. And Onsager, in 1949, published what is now referred to as Onsager's conjecture in connection, motivated by turbulence, and in connection with hypothetical weak solutions of the Euler equation. And he conjectured that for the three-dimensional Euler equation, weak solutions with Holder continuity h greater than a third conserve energy. So they behave in the way that we almost automatically assume our solutions are behaving for the Euler equation. We have conservation of energy. However, solutions that are not this smooth, solutions with Holder continuity h less than or equal to a third, could in fact dissipate energy. So if this is true, what will be happening in this three-dimensional inviscid fluid flow is that the roughness itself is dissipating energy. So a phenomena that perhaps is something that those of you in compressible fluids will not think as a strange behavior, but those of us in incompressible fluids at first thought do think of a strange possibility that the roughness actually provides dissipation. So these are the inviscid Euler equations, but it's possible that dissipation exists through the roughness of the solution. And this is now tends to be referred to as turbulent or sometimes anomalous dissipation. This is closely connected with ideas that were coming out of Kolmogorov's group at very much the same time, or even actually somewhat earlier than the work published by Onsager. Again, I apologize for using green, but so now we're considering the context of the Navier-Stokes equations and what is sometimes now referred to as Kolmogorov's 1941 law. He apparently has a lot of laws, or sometimes referred to as the five-thirds law. So this is now looking in Fourier space and considering the energy spectrum in Fourier space. So here we have the energy spectrum in what is now known as the inertial range, the inertial range of frequencies. And roughly speaking, the inertial range is the range of frequencies for which the nonlinear term and the viscous dissipative term are in balance in the Navier-Stokes equations. And in this range, he conjectures that the energy spectrum has the following form. A constant, this object, epsilon bar to the 2/3, and then k to the minus 5/3. Here, epsilon bar is the average dissipation rate in our viscous turbulent fluid, and k is the wave number. This is consistent if we consider, now going back to physical space, this k to the minus 5/3 scaling is consistent in physical space with the Hölder exponent being h equals a third in the statistically average sense. So one once again has these features that Onsager and Kolmogorov in the context of turbulence came up with the scaling, and these numbers are in fact just very intrinsic numbers coming from a straightforward scaling of the fluid equations. But a very important feature of Kolmogorov's law is that epsilon bar, the average dissipation rate, does not vanish in the limit of vanishing viscosity. So one might guess if the dissipation in our turbulent fluid is coming purely from viscous effects, from molecular effects, then that will disappear in the limit of vanishing viscosity. But a crucial feature of Kolmogorov's law is that epsilon bar does not vanish in the limit of vanishing viscosity. And then, of course, one might very well ask, well, what is the relationship between the dissipation rate coming from Navier-Stokes equations in the limit of vanishing viscosity and this turbulent or anomalous dissipation in the Euler equation, which is an effect of roughness? The limit of vanishing viscosity, as we all know, is an extremely subtle singular limit, and this is an illustration of it. One effect is viscous dissipation, the other effect is dissipation due to roughness. What do they have to do with each other? And yet, in the limit, as when you set the viscosity equal to zero, you go from Euler to Navier-Stokes. So it is intriguing to think that there should be a strong relationship between the dissipation rate in the two situations in the limit of vanishing viscosity, but that, for the full fluid equations, is certainly a very open question. So what have mathematicians done with this problem? Well, they have done some things. And in particular, Onsager's conjecture, this is the conjecture for the inviscid Euler equations, has received a considerable amount of attention in the past, 15 years, 20 years. And one of the early results in a sort of mathematical spirit rather than the spirit of the physicists working on turbulence was done by Greg Einke, where he proved conservation of energy for the Euler equations under a slightly stronger assumption than Onsager's conjecture, named when h is greater than a third. This paper was published in 1994. I gather from Greg, it was actually written 2 years before, and it was one of these cases where the editor lost the paper. So it was actually published only in 1994. So that meant it was actually published in the same year as a paper of Konstantin Wainana and Idris Titi, who knew of Einke's paper and proved a result in a much more elegant and concise way, making use of Besov spaces. So they proved conservation of energy for the Euler equation in the Besov space, B alpha 3 infinity for alpha greater than a third. This result was strengthened somewhat later by Duchamp and Robert, who again proved conservation of energy for the Euler equation under a slightly weaker condition and in a slightly different spirit than the proof of Constantino and Titi. And now what I'll be describing is a paper that the four of us have recently written, where we again improve matters a little bit. We prove conservation of energy in the Besov space, B a third, 3, infinity vanishing. So we actually get to the sort of Holder exponent a third conjectured by Onsaga, but now we need another condition here. We need the condition that not only, which I'll define precisely in a moment, we need a condition that the object that will be finite in such spaces is not only finite but actually vanishes. So that's the theorem that I would like to describe in a little more detail to you now. So the theorem says that every weak solution of the Euler equation, assuming such exists, in the function space L3 in time and B a third 3 infinity vanishing in space conserves energy. And this strengthens the previous results. In particular, it strengthens the results of Duchamp and Robert because it's possible to find an example of a divergence-free vector field that lives in this space but doesn't satisfy Duchamp and Robert's condition. And in fact, we conjecture that this is the borderline space. So we conjecture that if we dropped this vanishing condition, that in fact conservation of energy cannot be proved to hold. This is a conjecture for which we have some evidence, but we haven't proved. Pardon? We conjecture that it cannot be proved to hold. Now, what can be proved about weak solutions of the Euler equation are, I mean, they're all hypothetical. So, and what of course we would really like to do is get an example of an actual weak solution of the Euler equation in the function space where we delete this vanishing condition, where energy is not conserved. What we actually have is an example of a divergence-free vector field in the function space without the vanishing condition, where the concept that I will call the flux of the energy, at least described in Littlewood-Paley, in terms of Littlewood-Paley pieces, where that flux is positive. So, but this is not an actual solution of the Euler equation. It is mere telling you that there is a vector field out there for whom the flux doesn't vanish. Hence, if you can use that to construct a weak solution of the Euler equation, then we would have Onsaga's conjecture in the other direction. Well, it could be the initial data. Then what would have to do is put in forcing in order to have the equation actually satisfied, and the forcing is ghastly. So it's not satisfactory. But one could try it as initial data. But yes, Jim? That's interesting. I don't, again, basically unknown, because in order to be able to definitively say yes, if we replace one third by one third minus, then in fact, energy balance doesn't, you know, we don't have conservation of energy. We would need an example, and for weak solutions of the Euler equation, we don't have any examples with any smoothness. So there are the examples of Scheffer, Delalis, and Scheffer-Kiwi, which are only in L2, but only in L2. So if all we considered was L2, yes. But then these examples, they're non-unique. They certainly don't conserve energy, but they're not close to the Onsaga border. And there was forcing. Yes. It, without yeah, without forcing.
Did you have regular solutions that
was energy?
No.
Yes. In their examples, their forcing goes to zero. They put in force, or at least the Schnellmann example is forced with the forcing disappear.
Yeah, but I have admission these are even solutions.
Yes, one can question, are these solutions? But certainly, looking for solutions with 1/3 minus epsilon is far beyond what anyone has at the moment. So actually, that was my transparency, what I was going to mention this. That this existence of a weak solution with any positive smoothness in space that doesn't conserve energy remains open. And just mentioning there are these sort of classical results, which we could think of as classical because they've been around for more than 10 years, and then the recent results of Delalis and Shepard-Kidi, proving again that weak solutions which are only in L2 will give you an example of non-uniqueness and non-conservation of energy. But not, we are far from, it appears, finding weak solutions to the Euler equation that have any smoothness in space. So these things are rather hypothetical. Well, to give you some little more detail, I've been referring to this function space. How is it defined? Well, it's the space of tempered distributions in R3, where the limit as j goes to infinity of this quantity lambda sub j is 2 to the j multiplied by the L3 norm of the Littlewood-Paley piece of u goes to 0 as j goes to infinity. So we don't have it finite as we would if we deleted the vanishing condition. We want it actually to go to 0 as j goes to infinity. And just to point out, there is this embedding of function spaces. H5/6 is in B1/3P for all p greater than or equal to 2, which embeds in B1/3 infinity vanishing our function space, which embeds in B1/3 infinity. And this H5/6, of course, is sort of reminiscent of the Kolmogorov k to the minus 5/3 energy spectrum. So, what is behind our theorem? Well, what we're concerned with is the energy flux, and we're going to make a definition for what we mean by the energy flux by considering Fourier space and decomposing Fourier space into dyadic shells. And so what we're going to define is the energy flux due to the non-interactions in the Euler equation, the energy flux to a sphere of radius 2 to the j. And to define that, first of all, we'll do the standard definitions in terms of Littlewood-Paley pieces. We'll define the operator Sj of u in the following fashion. F is the script F, supposed to be script is the Fourier transform, and chi here is a cutoff function supported in a ball of radius 1 with chi equals 1 when psi lies between 0 and a half. And then delta sub j, the Littlewood-Paley piece, then will be the difference of Sj plus 1 of u and Sju. And it's in terms of these objects that we're going to define our energy flux through the sphere of radius 2 to the j. So in particular, here is the definition that we take for the energy flux through the sphere of radius 2 to the j is the following object. Again, it's this trilinear term, and it's going to be trilinear with this being the operator Sj repeated twice on u. Then if we use as a test function Sj squared of u in the weak formulation of the Euler equation, then it's quite easy to show that we get the following holding So this is defined for any divergence-free vector field. If we take a test function and then consider U to be a weak solution of the Euler equation with this as the test function, we see almost immediately that the energy in this shell, the time derivative of the energy in the shell, is this flux, is given by the flux through the shell with this definition. If taking the limit as j goes to infinity, then we get the flux through whole space, and that's the total flux, pi. So taking the limit as j goes to infinity, then, of this object where U is a weak solution of the Euler equation, we get that the time derivative of the total energy of this weak solution to the Euler equation is this object, the flux capital pi. So, the theorem that allows us to prove Onsager's conjecture in one direction is the following. We have the following estimate on the flux, the magnitude of the flux through the sphere of radius 2 to the j, and it's the following object. And now you see why we make use of the function space that we're working in. So for this function space, b a third, 3, infinity vanishing, this term as I goes to infinity vanishes, and we see therefore as we take j going to infinity and take look at the total flux, for any vector field u that lies in this vector field, lies in this function space, and it's all divergence free, the upper bound here vanishes, and so pi is equal to zero. We actually see something more from this theorem than what we were looking for, that pi is equal to zero for u in that function space. This actually also gives a description of the locality of the interaction, because you can see, obviously, when j and I are far apart, the term that we have here is a strongly decaying term. So we see that the flux coming from the nonlinear interaction is dependent on interaction between wave numbers that are close together. This is a philosophy that underlies a lot of the treatment of turbulent fluids, underlies a lot of the models that one has for the nonlinear interaction in the fluid equation, and it's nice to see sort of very explicitly this particular sort of description of the flux given in terms of Littlewood-Paley pieces. We see very clearly this nonlinear interaction is true for the three-dimensional Euler equation. It's not true in two dimensions, which is good, but it is true in three dimensions. In two dimensions, one can look at an equivalent expression for the entropy and find that we have locality in the infrared but not in the ultraviolet. So, interpreting that result for solutions, weak solutions to the Euler equation, then what we show is that the total energy of, any divergence-free vector field in this function space, L2, vanishes, and in particular, every weak solution to the Euler equation that belongs to the function space, L3 in time, our function space b a third, 3 infinity vanishing, intersection L2 conserves energy. So this, as we say, strengthens the previous results and leads us to our conjecture that this, in fact, is the sharp function space beyond which one couldn't prove that the flux vanishes for a divergence-free vector field in this space b a third 3 infinity, because we have an example of a divergence-free vector field that gives positive transfer of energy through the frequency space, so that this limit as j goes to infinity of the infimum of the flux through the jth shell is actually greater than a positive constant. So again, to stress, this does not give the existence of a weak solution of Euler equation, but it does tell us that if we're just considering the possible divergence free vector fields that are out there in three dimensions, then this flux, there is at least one example, and in fact there will be whole classes of examples, where the flux does not vanish. So it's suggestive that this function space, if there is a borderline function space for the Euler equations, in other words, if weak solutions to the Euler equations exist that do not conserve energy, it is suggestive that one may want to look in this function space or, of course, function spaces embedded inside that one. So, let's see, I think I'll skip helicity, but what does this say for the Navier-Stokes equations? Well, when we turn to the Navier-Stokes equations, we're on somewhat firmer ground, because here at least we know the existence of, the so-called Urey-Hopf weak solutions for the Navier-Stokes equations. So take U, zero, the initial conditions in L2, Navier-Stokes equations would often come with forcing. Then, again, the definition of a weak solution is given in the following fashion, integrated against test functions, again, test functions that are divergence-free. Now, the one important issue about weak or Urey-Hopf solutions to the Navier-Stokes equations is, do they actually satisfy the energy balance condition? It can be proved that they do, that they satisfy the energy inequality, but do they satisfy, does a particular given solution of this form satisfy the energy equality? And whether or not that happens is very much dependent on what happens to the trilinear term. How does that trilinear term behave? And this trilinear term, of course, is exactly the same for the trilinear term that comes from Euler or the trilinear term that comes from Navier-Stokes. So if we're considering it as how do these vectors, how do the flux due to these vector fields and vector field interaction behave, the problem is the same whether it's Euler or Navier-Stokes. So the result for the flux that we found will carry over from Euler to Navier-Stokes, and in particular, it will give us a result concerning the energy equality for weak solutions of the Navier-Stokes equations. So, as I say, a question that has concerned a number of people and is connected with the talk of Professor Yao that we heard earlier, does a given solution to the Navier-Stokes equation satisfy actually the energy equality? And there have been many papers on this, probably dating first of all to the paper of Seren, but work of Lyons, Ladizhenskaya, Shinbrod, Kukovica, etc., which give conditions, function space conditions, for the velocity field under which the answer is yes, it satisfies the energy equality. And one class of answers for which it will be yes is if U is in the function space 2 over R plus 2 over S, where rather function space LR in time, LS in space, where 2 over R plus 2 over S is less than or equal to 1 for S greater than or equal to 4. This is an interpolation of the condition that we saw before, the 2 over R plus 3 over S is less than 1 with S less than or equal to 3. There are various conditions that basically are all all the LRLS conditions really come from interpolation, and our condition is now a little different because our condition is going to be a condition for U in the function space B a third 3 infinity. So what we have shown is that any vector field in the condition in the space B a third 3 infinity vanishing will give rise to zero total flux, in other words, a zero contribution from the trilinear term. And if the solution is also a solution of the Navier-Stokes equations, then it's going to, in B3 infinity vanishing, if it's Navier-Stokes, it will also be in B3 infinity. So any solution to the Navier-Stokes equations in this function space will satisfy the energy equality because the trilinear term is zero. So that gives a slightly different flavor of a condition under which the Urey-Hopf solutions satisfy the energy equality. We can And all the results that I've described up to now are in R3. In the case of the Navier-Stokes equation in a bounded domain, in omega in R3, we can prove a version of this result, which actually is proved even more easily based on a decomposition not into Littlewood-Paley pieces, but based on the eigenfunctions of the basically a fractional power of the Stokes operator. The Stokes operator is the projection of the Laplacian onto the space of divergence free functions. So what we have is we have that the energy equality holds for weak solutions in L3 in time and V to the 5/6, whereas I say V to the 5/6 is the domain of the fractional power of the Stokes operator A 5/12. If we were considering the periodic case, then V5/6 is in fact H5/6. So we're back to that particular Sobolev space that's in agreement with Kolmogorov's law in the inertial range. So our result will say that this, in this situation, the for weak solutions of the Navier-Stokes, Leray-Hoff weak solutions of the Navier-Stokes equations, the energy equality holds. And one might ask, how does that connect with the LRLS conditions? And that's something we're interested in investigating. But I think my time is up, so thank you very much.